Have you seen Twitter?
You know I don't do that rubbish.
Okay, well, I do. And Olivia has posted a picture of her mum and dad saying, already lost mum, now daddy's in hospital fighting for his life. Can't face losing him too. Hashtag pray for Duncan.
Pray for Duncan. Give me strength.
Hello and welcome to episode 35 of The Talk of the Street, the world's second longest running unofficial Coronation Street catch-up podcast that's surviving on recycled soda cans, eating roadkill over the sink and watching episodes of Corrie through the window of our local Rumbelows. I'm Gavin.
And I'm Chris, and I'm absolutely terrified.
So let me check, you're definitely not Helen then.
Unless I've had subconscious gender reassignment surgery, I am in fact an English roadie who has never done this before.
And if you have, it's worked out perfectly. You're sounding the part, certainly.
The voice is good. Yes, the voice is quite convincing, isn't it? I was rather hoping for more Morgan Freeman and less Ringo's kid sister, but we'll go with it, you know?
We can all hope. So you're Chris. Yes,
I
that
am.
One.
Yep.
I didn't ask Chris, no, not that one, to fill in for Helen. I got the feeling that Chris, no, not that one, isn't really much of a Coronation Street fan, so this would probably be a far more combative affair than I'm expecting.
Who is this other Chris of whom you speak?
There was a Chris who wrote in a few times in the earlier days of the podcast, basically just complaining about stuff, which is, to be fair, most of our mailbag. So regular listeners will already know that Chris, yes that one, is a friend of the podcast, writing in regularly and eloquently with his thoughts and opinions and confirmation of Squire Padlock purchases. Thanks so much for doing this, by the way, I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
So I think in this episode, or maybe last week's episode, it takes us beyond the episode count of Mice and Ken, which was my barometer of making this worthwhile. If we could get beyond those episodes, then the cost of the feed was officially neutral. And any more than that is a bonus.
Excellent.
My favourite of Mice and Ken episode title was Increasingly Erotic Death by Quicksand.
I must have heard it. It slipped my mind, but I did listen to all of those.
I suppose that was the one where, was it Peter was dying in quicksand?
No, it was when Nick and Peter daggers drawn over Leanne or Toya or Carla or one of the merry-go-round of biatches. Oh, you might want to edit that out. Anyway, Nick ended up in quicksand and Peter, a sworn enemy at the time, you know, did the gallant thing and pulled him out. Nearly said off. He said off then.
That was the most Blazing Saddles episode of Coronation Street I can remember.
is that a keenly contested arena there?
Well, it's probably best maybe we just stick away from Blazing Saddles. So our Helen update, she is out of hospital and she's home. She had her surgery on Wednesday, everything went well. She's just recovering now on a cocktail of painkillers to ease her pain a little bit. So, but she's doing well, and she was planning on coming down and sticking her head in front of the microphone at some point. So we'll see if that happens or not.
Do you think she might be able to at least manage a bloop, 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 bloop at the appointing moment?
We can but hope. We shall see. So shall we preamble, my Chris?
Careful. Yes, let's do it.
Okay, so our mailbag, Pearl left a gif of a man applauding on our Facebook feed. Thank you for that, Pearl. And Heather, in a comment that I assume was based on our assertion that there were some pretty unfeasible things happening last week, insisted, look, it's a soap. But yeah, I get that. I get that not everything has to add up, but when things don't add up, and don't add up so spectacularly, it's like the writers noticed these holes and either didn't care or couldn't think of a way for the plot to work with the holes filled in. Either way, some of that was pretty lazy writing last week, I thought.
I'm probably not the best person to offer a rational and impartial critique because I believe all of it. Apart from when Billy plummeted 200 feet onto his back and then was walking within a couple of weeks. No, I mean, most of it, I just blindly go along with it.
Yes, some of it I'm happy to do that with, but there's other parts of it where... And I don't want to get too bogged down in the minutia of money laundering regulation, but there's some of it that you just think, don't think that would happen.
Yeah, fair point.
Anyway, Bonnie said, I like Angie, I wish she had a better storyline and didn't have to leave. I totally agree with that. I really liked Angie.
Yep, she was fine. Liked her a lot.
A friend of the podcast, John, said, another good review, guys, last week for a top-rated show. They really need to start doing better research for things like phone box redial, bank checks, police procedures, etc., etc. After all, it's supposed to be real life. It's bugging me too about the wipeout in a film, but there's a double wipeout at the end of John Newman's video for Love Me Again. And Teaser, who's a regular correspondent, thinks that I'm thinking of Final Destination, while non-Canadian Helen thinks I'm thinking of Meet Joe Black. There's now a confusing number of Helens involved in this podcast. I'm not sure what I'm thinking of for that scene where Duncan was run over by the van last week, but I definitely remember seeing it somewhere.
It caught me by surprise, but I don't think I've seen it anywhere else. But then I'm not a big film watcher, generally.
And so talking of Helens, talking of which, lovely Canadian Helen emailed to say, I just wanted to wish Helen all the best for her upcoming surgery and for a quick recovery so she can make it back on the talk of the street. Get lots of rest, Helen, and enjoy watching Corey while you recover. So thanks very much for that, lovely Canadian Helen. Hindsight Corner.
I can't do it. It feels, oh no, it's not my part. Bloop, 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 bloop. And indeed, furthermore.
You can do it.
Does it not feel like you're being unfaithful here?
Maybe a little bit.
I'm treading on her toes. Carry on.
I'll show her afterwards.
Fair play.
I refer to Emmerdale as being an everyday story of country folk, and though I did correct myself at the time, I'm happy to confirm that this actually does refer to The Archers and not Emmerdale at all, which is BBC's radio drama serial that's approaching its 70th anniversary in the next couple of years. Emmerdale is a relative youngster at 48, focuses on the fictitious village in the Yorkshire Dales, the dramas of the Sugden, King and Dingle families. Its probably most famous storyline occurred in 93 when a plane crashed over the village, wiping out several major characters. And this allowed writers to basically start from scratch and elevated Emmerdale from the quaint, sleepy time show it was into the stratosphere of Corrie and that London soap. The storyline was controversial, happening as it did 5 years almost to the day after the Lockerbie disaster. Can you remember what you were doing the night of the Lockerbie disaster, Chris?
I do not, to be honest. I remember it very clearly. But no, I can remember where I was when I first watched Emmerdale, which isn't quite the same degree of gravitas that you're looking for there. Yeah.
Well, there was a segue that deserved the word gravitas, it was that one.
Thank you very much.
I think I was getting off with a girl called Laura Witherspoon whilst watching a Blackadder Christmas special. Was there a Blackadder Christmas Carol? I think there was.
It was a fine episode, that one, yeah.
That's what I was watching.
I misunderstood then you were getting off with Laura with a spoon.
Oh, no.
Laura's creative. They do things differently at North of the Border. Carry on.
There was no cutlery involved, I think. Yeah.
You've changed.
Yeah, once bitten, twice shy. So our Twitter follower count remains steady at 33. I'm not quite sure whether to continue doing this or not. It seems to be an exercise in proving how unpopular we are on Twitter. So, what you drinking, Chris?
We forgot about this, but I'm actually drinking a Robinson's, let me just read it, Robinson's Fruit Creations with twice the fruit in delicious peach and raspberry.
You've changed.
I know. It says no added sugar, which probably means it was created in a lab by scientists.
It's like all Robinson's stuff is like that, isn't it?
Probably. I don't think there's anything there that ever existed independently in nature.
Not naturally. I think all the molecules that are involved in Robinson's exist in a lab for 20 seconds and then just disappear into nothingness again. This episode of The Talk of the Street is sponsored by Robinson's Fruit Biology.
Shortly before being sued by them for slanderous comments.
Yeah. Well, we never got sued by...
by Nestle, and I was pretty horrible to Nestle a few weeks ago, so they can still suck my balls.
Yes, indeed. I do like a Kit Kat, though. Sorry, I've let you down.
Shall we dive in, then?
I suppose we probably should.
Okay, we started off the week with Sally and Duncan's story. We had 9 storylines last week. There are a mere 5 this week, and most of the episodes is taken up by this one, which is Sally and Duncan and Gina. On Monday, we open with Tim outside reading all about it. A fraudster hit by van, says the Weather Gazette. Along comes Sophie, who wants to know what Tim did to Duncan. He denies any involvement, and she frog marches him back to the house while Gina watches on. At home, Sophie is showing Olivia's Twitter to Tim. She's lost her mum and can't face losing her dad and has posted a photo of them together. Hashtag pray for Duncan. Is it strange that his daughter wouldn't do hashtag pray for dad?
That's a good point. I mean, I don't do any social media stuff, so I'm not that familiar with the etiquette and indeed mechanics of it. But yeah, she wouldn't call him Duncan, would she?
Don't think so.
Maybe she was, anyway, I don't know, maybe she was adopted or something. We don't know anything about her story, do we?
Or maybe she just has a relationship with her father the same way that David has with Gail. Because he calls her Gail all the time, which makes me sad. So Sophie knows Tim wanted to beat Duncan up, and he admits to shouting at him and chasing him for a bit. Sophie reminds us all that if Duncan dies, he can't confess. And so she's off up the hospital to see if he's still alive. At the hospital, Sophie has somehow found Duncan. Olivia's there and wants Sophie gone. Olivia doesn't know what happened, so Sophie wonders if Olivia thinks her dad tried to kill himself. And she goes on to insist that her mum is alive. Olivia isn't interested. If he dies, it's Sophie's fault. Now GTF before I call the police, she says. In prison, Sally's cell has been messed up a bit while she was out, and someone has scrawled RIP on the wall and scrunched up her photo with Tim. And this upsets Sally enormously.
I can see that.
Yeah, somebody just picked up that photo and just scrunched it into a ball. That'll learn you.
Well, I think in combination with the death threat, it might be quite, might kind of, you know, make you slightly disturbed.
I guess in isolation, maybe the scrunched up photo wasn't such a big deal. But yeah, the scrawled RIP and tomato ketchup or whatever it was. Yeah. Maybe that just blazes the ante somewhat.
Ah, bloody snowflakes.
Sophie is leaving and on the phone to Tim, explaining that Duncan is still alive. She's going to hang around for more information, and at this, who should walk in but May? She's got that direct Costa Rica to Weatherfield service that Air Weatherfield are offering. And she's back in the UK less than 24 hours after Duncan jumped in front of a van. She's looking for Duncan, but has no idea what ward he's in or if he's even in this hospital. The receptionist will go check while Sophie compares this woman to the photo on Twitter from earlier. Sophie introduces herself as the neighbour and tells May he's on death's door and has been transferred to a specialist unit, and so May agrees to go with, and the two of them leave. That was a little strange, I thought. I was wondering what Sophie was up to at this point.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. And it just, would she say, I'll just get in a van with you, in a car with you and go somewhere, rather than speaking to somebody with, you know, I don't know, a medical uniform on of some sort.
Of which there were a few just hanging around. She could have spoken to someone, yeah. In the car park, Sophie is pretending to pay for parking, but is actually taking photos of May. She calls Tim and tells him that she has her. Tim wants Sophie to take her to the police, but Sophie has a better idea. Or more accurately, Sophie has an alternative idea. Yeah. She's going to drive around pointlessly for a bit, pretending to go to a hospital that doesn't exist, and she tells Tim to get to Duncan and blackmail him to confess when he wakes up. A foolproof plan.
Even as they were doing, as it, like I say, I do generally believe everything that goes on in here, but I just thought that was absurd.
Yes. Just go to the police. Meanwhile, Duncan wakes up. Olivia calls for a nurse, and Duncan wants Olivia to call the police. Someone tried to kill him, he says. So then Sophie is driving May around, who's quizzing her about the accident, and Sophie reprises the potential suicide story. She really is going all in on this one. May doesn't buy it. Sophie asks if Duncan was having any problems, what with the court case and the dead wife. May doesn't give anything away, but is becoming suspicious that they're driving around in circles, which they are. In prison, people are bumping into Sally. Her friend Jodie tells her to stay in her cell, but Sally's not safe there. And Jodie tells Sally that Marcy gets out of segregation tomorrow, and Sally shits herself a wee bit.
I can see that.
With Olivia taking a break, Tim moves in on Duncan. Oh, I made that sound pretty creepy. Tim says that Duncan is going to call the police and tell him not to come because they've got his wife and they're both going down for fraud unless he plays ball. Get it right, fucking up ye, says Tim. Or words to that effect.
Yes.
So Tim is showing Duncan the photo Sophie took, but Duncan is sticking to his guns. It's an old photo. His wife died of a stroke a year ago. Well, let's see what your daughter thinks, says Tim, and that seems to get a reaction. Tim insists he confesses because if he doesn't, then he and May will both go to prison for fraud and Olivia will know what a pair of scumbags they are. Still, Duncan keeps his poker face. He doesn't believe any of this. Right, says Tim. Let's get May on the phone then, shall we? So meanwhile, May is getting more and more suspicious and then Sophie pretends that the car has broken down, which she does by just turning the car in.
I'm walking around, yeah, I'm stopping in Coronation Street and going to look at the engine.
She grabs her phone, which has a notification, and pops the bonnet. She calls Tim, who wants May on the phone. Sophie doesn't think it's a good idea, but has to relent. But by this time, May has done a runner. See, this was the flaw in the plan of driving around with no real destination to go to and driving around in circles. In a place where I assume that May is probably reasonably familiar with. She's kind of from the area, isn't she?
Do we know that?
Well, Duncan stays nearby.
Well, she probably... Yeah, fair point, I suppose. I mean, she wouldn't necessarily know the area around Coronation Street and Victoria Street, but she'd know where hospitals were and weren't.
Yes. Or the existence of a hospital that Sophie can only think is called Memorial something or other. But anyway. At Roy's Rolls, a frantic Sophie is looking for May. Gina asks what's up, and Sophie shows her the picture. Gina's like a bloodhound, and the two of them set off to find her. You go that way, I'll go this way, says Gina. Meanwhile, back at Duncan's bed, Tim has to admit that they've lost May, which allows Duncan to stick to the dead wife line, and then he pushes the button to get a nurse. Tim has nothing, he says. Yeah, this is the problem with taking May on this wild goose chase round about the streets of Weatherfield rather than taking her to the police or taking her to the hospital, where she can see her daughter, or more importantly, where her daughter can see her.
Fair point, yeah, that would have been a more logical thing to do.
Because her daughter really does think that she's dead.
It seems impossibly cruel for the parents. I know it's been done before, you know, in real life, if you will, but yeah.
The canoe guy.
Say again?
The canoe guy.
Oh, the canoe guy, yes, exactly.
He famously didn't really care a shit for his... For his kids.
Was he trying to escape justice, or was that another insurance job? I don't remember.
I think it was just an insurance job. I don't think he was guilty of anything other than that.
You've got to really, really like money to make that something that you'd want to do, isn't it? Or really, really dislike your children.
Yes, or a combination of the two, yeah. Gina spots May coming out of Costa Coffee and stops her in her tracks. She introduces herself as a sister of the woman she and Duncan scammed, but May genuinely seems to not have a clue who Sally Metcalf is or what went on. There was a mix-up with funds at the council, that's all she knows about. Aren't you supposed to be dead, says Gina. There's a way out of this. Convince Duncan to tell the truth, if not for Sally, then for Olivia. So that's Gina trying to make amends for her.
A way out in one way? In what way? Because she's going to be incriminating herself and her husband.
Yeah, I'm never too clear on exactly what this whole way out really is. I think it's kind of sketched upon, but it's not really...
I mean, morally, there's a way out. She could possibly, you know, be less of a shit.
Yes, and maybe that's enough.
Maybe it is.
So hospital security arrive at Duncan's room and they throw Tim out. And then Gina arrives at Duncan's room with a visitor. It's May. She's thrilled to see he's alive. He tells her he needs to leave. The police will be here soon. Then May asks if Gina is telling the truth. All these other lives have been ruined. That was never in the plan. Duncan reveals that there was no other way to pay the medical bills, but all May ever needed was Duncan and Olivia. It's killing her that she's grieving for a mother who's still alive, and she tells Duncan to do the right thing. At this, in come the police, who understand Duncan wants to report a crime. I got the feeling that we were supposed to feel a little bit sorry for Duncan here.
Yeah, I mean, it was at the time I wasn't sure whether he was going to report Tim or report his own crime. And yeah. Obviously, it came clear later on. I do find it very difficult to have any sympathy for Duncan whatsoever.
Yeah, but I think they tried to make us think that he was doing it for the right reasons, because he couldn't pay for the medical bills in Costa Rica otherwise. So right. They had to pull this scam. And then May seems to wait a year before saying all she ever needed was Duncan and Olivia, and I don't really feel comfortable about my daughter thinking that I'm dead. It's taken a little while for all this to sink in a little bit.
Yeah, I mean,
specifically, she's been on her own in Costa Rica.
Did they not have any kind of travel insurance to cover this as well? I'm going into this too deeply, aren't I?
Well, this is how I like to pour scorn on these storylines, by pointing out the... Yeah, maybe some holiday insurance would have worked here. Back at home, Tim is ready to do a runner before he gets charged with attempted murder. Sophie tries to talk him round, but then it becomes a moot point because the police are there. But they don't want to nick him. They're there to explain that Duncan has confessed.
Hallelujah!
Yay! That Sally had nothing to do with it, and they advise him to get their legal representatives informed so that they can go about getting Sally out. And while Tim and Sophie celebrate, Gina slinks by quietly and unnoticed, and only slightly pleased with her day's work. But yeah, Duncan has finally confessed.
Fantastic.
It's a long story, this. This started in the summer, I think, last year, didn't it?
About when he first appeared with the kind of, my wife died of a stroke, can I have some money? Yeah. Yeah.
So it finally pays off just by the wife coming in and basically telling him to do the right thing.
I think so, yeah. It's a slight damp squib of an ending, wasn't it, really?
A little bit. So Wednesday then, Paula, Sophie and Tim are on their way to do some appeal-related stuff to get Sally out. Then Imran comes along and is now helping Paula. He was working for Duncan literally two episodes ago.
Yeah, does he cease to be a client once, I guess he does, once that there's been a judgment made and a conviction, I suppose?
Yeah, now that he's confessed, maybe he's absolved of his legal responsibility to represent that guy and not jump ship and help out Sally. But anyway, that's what Imran does, and he does it in his lovely jacket, so that's okay.
I don't remember it. Describe it to me.
The jacket is kind of plaid and like a checkered affair. It doesn't really look like something that Imran would ever wear, but where it he does, it's a kind of grey and black sort of thing.
Could you carry it off, do you think?
I don't think I really have the skin tones to do that, no. I think it would just bleach me out.
we're going to have to look into this now, aren't we?
Yes. Paula thinks there's a good chance that she'll be home for tea time. At the Knicker factory, Duncan's confession is all that Sean and Izzy can talk about. They ask Gina for the inside track. She plays dumb for a bit, then tells them that Duncan's wife was the one who made him see sense. Gina just wants to get Sally home and everything back to normal. Fat chance, says Sean. You tried to get your hold off of Tim. And Sally's still going to be mad about that. Unless, says Izzy, Gina did something amazing yesterday.
Too little, too late, as far as I'm concerned, but carry on.
Yeah, that's what I think. At prison visiting, Sally can't wait to get out. It's like a dream. It might be today or tomorrow, says Sophie, depending on how quickly Paula gets the appeal lodged. But Sally needs out today. Marcia gets out later and will kick the shit out of her. So at Roy's Rolls, it's a big day for Tim learning stuff. He finds out from Paula that the appeal might not be heard today, and he learns from Izzy that Gina is the reason Duncan confessed, because she's the one who found May, and this surprised Sophie too. But just like you, Chris, it doesn't seem to cut much ice with Tim or Sophie.
Correct.
In their cell, Sally finds out there's been no word of a release yet from the guard, and then Marcia arrives telling her her problems have just begun, and she's got a shank, and she's about to stab Sally when Jodie appears to knock Marcia out with a pool ball in a sock. Chris, did this remind you of the BBC TV drama and movie Scum?
I should tell you at this point that anything that happens on the screen, if it doesn't take place in Weatherfield or Emmerdale or on a football pitch, I probably haven't seen it.
So, yes, it does remind you of Scum.
Okay, I've never seen that, but on you go.
Oh, I don't know if you're a child of the 80s or not. You're a child of the 80s?
I was alive in the 80s, but I was... no, I wouldn't have been now. 70s, I suppose.
All right, it was a pretty famous, hard-hitting BBC drama set in a borstal. Don't know if that rings any bells or not.
None whatsoever.
None whatsoever. Let's skate on then. It was weird because she didn't hit Marcia on the head, or not that I could see, so I'm not sure how all that worked out. And I think I would have preferred Sally to have stood up for Marcia. Or I think I would have preferred
She wouldn't have stood a chance, though, would she?
I don't know if Sally knows her own strength. She's never really tried. But yeah, but Joe Day with a pool ball and a sock seems to be the way to go.
I mean, had she been armed with, let's say, an estate agent sign, maybe she'd have a better chance of defending herself.
Yes, we shall get to that.
But let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Other rovers, Tim and Sophie are worried that Sally won't get out today, but Imran knows the judge's assistant and goes off to make a few calls. Back at the prison, Yorkshire Stone Cold Steve Austin is furious about this assault on a well-known prison ne'er-do-well. Sally is worried about Jodie's future following this, but Jodie and her pals all owe Sally one for starting all those classes and listening to them. Jodie seems like she can handle herself. Then Yorkshire Stone Cold Steve Austin says this was a violent assault and he'll need to get statements, and Sally's going nowhere just yet. Back at the Rovers, Tim is in no mood to thank Gina for her role in this or Imran for getting the judge to agree to a late sitting, and he tells Craig that he can tell his copper friends that they were fucking useless too. And at that, Sally walks into the pub because that's the first place she would go on her release. Hiya, love, she says. And Sally's back. Yay!
Woohoo.
A free round from Johnny has calmed Tim down a bit, and Sally reminds Sophie that although she's out, she's not exactly free just yet. There's still the appeal. Gina comes over to welcome her home, but Sally tells her to GTF. Gina may have helped her get out, but she was the one who put her inside in the first place, which isn't strictly true.
No.
While Tim is getting champagne and the entire pub is singing Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree, Peter joins Sally and sympathises with her. Prison changes you, he says, and Sally does look changed. Sally leaves and Tim goes after her. At home, Tim is showing off his We'll Come Home sign. Sally's still fixated on how she nearly got knifed earlier on today. Tim says she's safe and home, but Sally doesn't think she'll ever feel safe again. And this seems to be a little theme that's happening when people come out of prison on Coronation Street. Prison changes you.
Well, I can't say I've ever experienced it, but I would imagine that would be the case.
So Peter is one of many people who will approach Sally in the coming days to regale her with their stories of being inside.
I think there's more people who've been inside than haven't on the street.
Yes, and we find out quite a few of them on Friday. So on Friday, Sally's on the phone to the estate agents. She wants the house off the market, and that sign taken down today. It's a bloody eyesore. Meanwhile, Tim is telling Faye how well Sally's doing, but Faye tells him that Anna was a right mess when she got out, and Tim thinks she just needs time to adjust, and they've managed to set up a payment plan with Paula. God, that was difficult to say. A payment plan with Paula.
Yeah, not as difficult it will be to actually meet the bill. Was it £23,000? And she worked in a knicker factory, and he sometimes drives a cab?
Yeah, so let's think. 23,000 over what? 4 years, 5 years is probably 500? 500 a month or something like that, maybe?
That's not going to happen.
No. That's an awful lot of knickers. An awful lot of driving a cab. But this is a payment plan that presumably... Oh, God, there's so many P's. A payment plan with Paula that presumably could have been set up earlier before they tried to sell the house. Oh, no, because she couldn't work at the knicker factory. That's right.
That's true. And the house was intending to pay off the bill.
Yeah. So in the kitchen, Sally's putting everything to her liking. Not that bloody Gina's liking. Plus, she's going to the factory to see if she can get her job back. Tim reminds her that Gina will be there, and Sally says she's not about to let Gina steal her job like she tried to steal everything else.
Go, Sal.
Go, Sal, yeah. But meanwhile, in a separate but related storyline, Abby has an interview at the fishmonger's, and she goes to the salon to get all spruced up. Did you laugh at the word fishmonger? I did.
No, I didn't, but I did laugh at a little bit later on, which you're about to refer to, I think. Carry on.
Yeah. So David is nearly done when Abby brings up the subject of a viral video of a barber cutting homeless people's hair for free. You're not homeless, says David. I'm a little bit homeless, says Abby. Do you mean you can't pay for this haircut that I'm nearly finished, he asks. And I can pay for a little bit of it, she offers. And with that, David grabs his jacket and leaves her in the chair to rot. But Maria steps up and she finishes it off for her. So Sal's back at work in the factory. Welcome back. and everyone, even Beth a wee bit, seems happy to see her, but Sally ignores Gina, quite pointedly. Then later, everyone is trying too hard to make Sally welcome. She snaps at Gina, and then at Izzy, who's also been inside, and was offering to get Sally a baked potato. But Sally doesn't want a baked potato. If Sally wanted a baked potato, Sally would go and get herself a baked potato. Then Carla appears and bans Sally from ever saying baked potato ever again, and gives her the rest of the day off. Carla, who's also been inside, can sympathise, get home and get some rest for a week, she says. I don't remember Carla being inside.
No, I'm trying to... I think my history with the streets a little longer than yours, but I don't remember what it was for either.
But she said she was inside, though, right? I heard that.
I think so, yeah. I mean, back in the day, there was a time when Peter first started going to AA meetings where she was going down the same route and was an alcoholic, and then that seems to have gone away. So I don't know whether when she was doing a drinking, she'd, like, you know, smashed some things up or something, but I don't remember why she would have... No, we might have... There's a job for Hindsight Corner next week.
Yeah, she said that she could sympathise, so I'm just presuming. But this was a theme for this whole episode, was various people coming on to tell Sally that they'd also been inside. So anyway, at home, Sally's on the phone. Duncan has been remanded in custody while Sally has to wait to be officially declared innocent. Acquitted, I think is the word.
Yes.
Along comes Gina, not reading the room, and asks how it's going. And Sally rips the for sale sign out of the garden and attacks Gina with it, until Abby intervenes and throws the sign back in the garden and tells Gina to fuck off. Sally, for the first time today, actually looks happy. It's good to see Abby. And then Sally spots a prawn in Abby's hair. It seems there was a misunderstanding when the fishmonger told her to handle his pollock. She didn't know it was a fish, and the interview went south from there.
I did enjoy. I enjoyed the prawn in the hair. I think the punchline wasn't quite as good, but I did enjoy the prawn in the hair. That's a phrase I've never said before. I did enjoy the prawn in the hair. common words in fairly frequent usage, but rarely in that sequence. Do carry on.
Yeah, it's a sentence that I haven't typed out, I don't think, in my life, and also seems there was a misunderstanding when the fishmonger told her to handle his pollock. I think those are, what, 12 words that in the history of my... Probably in the history of the English language have never been typed out particularly in that order before.
Possibly in a script for Carry On. For Carry On. Yeah.
I thought Abby was absolutely fantastic in this episode, but particularly here, the way that she just handled the for sale sign by lobbing it over the hedge and telling Gina to bolt. And then just taking control of the whole situation.
She's a fantastic character, isn't she?
Isn't she amazing?
There's a long history of Coronation Street, you know, urchins with a heart of gold type thing, you know. But she's, you know, takes a place among the best, I think.
Yeah, I was quite unsure of her to start with when she was doing the whole druggy thing and kind of being the thorn in Seb's side and going on about the twins and that. But since then, she's become one of my favourite characters in the show, I think. She just delivers every time. She was brilliant in the prison. And now that they've got out, I think she's just been great with Sally as well. It's been fantastic to watch.
Yeah, I mean, she strikes me as maybe one of those characters that was brought in just to see how it went and became enormously popular and now is hopefully going to be there long term.
Yeah, I think so, because she's a cracking actress. She really did, she's so believable. So, Tim is trying to arrange the perfect welcome home for Sally, which seems to involve wine and the movie Magic Mike, which she accuses Steve of having. Then in comes Liz, it was her what loaned it, and she'll stick it through his door later on. So are you familiar with Magic Mike?
I am not.
I believe it's a movie about male strippers.
Fair enough.
Which seems to float Sally's boat. So, at the Rovers with Abby, Gail and Yasmin, Sally's finding it hard to get excited about being out, and Abby thinks they'd better fun in prison. Sally is grateful again for Abby's protection, and Gail, who has also been inside, wishes that she'd had someone like Abby to look after her. Abby's eyes could not get any wider. Holy shit, you were inside? Wrongly accused of fraud, just like Sal, says Gail, shining a light on the cyclical nature of Corey's storylines. Sally explains that her husband drowned trying to fake his own death. Well, we've all been there, says Abby.
I did laugh at that line.
Yes. It's, we've all been there, and she just throws Yasmin a quick little look. The boat was called Gale Force, and at this, Abby loses her shit. So Sally's night is getting a bit drunken while Tim and Sophie are frantically cleaning out the kitchen at home and preparing dinner. Tim has his best black and white checked shirt on, the top two buttons undone, and Sophie reckons Sally is a lucky lady.
They set the bar very low in the street, don't they?
Yes, they really do.
Said Brad Pitt.
Sally's back home with her new gang, and Tim is a bit taken aback and seems upset at Sally for being pished. He had plans for the evening, dinner and their hole. But Sally is more interested talking to Abby and thanking her again, and she wants Abby to move in with them. It's the least that she can do. And that, I think, is a great move.
It sets up so many great comedy moments, both between those two and obviously with Tim being resentful of his own space being invaded by another person too.
Absolutely. I think we can look forward to that in the weeks to come. But that, I think, is probably the end of the fraud storyline and maybe the start of the Sally adjusting to life outside again.
I think her inability to deal with life on the outside will go away very quickly. I think that's just... I think she'll be back to normal very quickly.
Yeah, because how long was she inside for?
I'm not sure whether or not the timescale that we see in the real world is supposed to be represented in Coronation Street, whether or not something that happens on a Wednesday when I'm watching it, the following Wednesday is a week later.
Well, I know what you mean. It's the... From Monday to Wednesday to Friday usually is 3 days in the Corrie universe, unless Britain's Got Talent is on, right. In which case Monday, Wednesday and Friday all happen on the same day, or usually Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday on Britain's Got Talent week, I think, isn't it? So she'll be inside for maybe a couple of months in the real world and maybe, what... Maybe 6 weeks or something like that?
Yeah, it didn't seem that long. I mean, I can see that she would be affected by constant threats upon her life and having her Polaroid scrunched up.
But she's no normal standard
card. No.
Anyway, that takes us to the end of that storyline. So our next one is Sinead and Daniel. And at this point, Helen would go, ugh.
I was about to affect a Helen-style groan, but I couldn't do it justice, I don't think.
So on Monday in Roy's Rolls, all the factory workers are hanging out while they wait on the factory to be opened, and Sinead and Daniel are there, and they're off to that hospital appointment for their scan results. Beth and Kirk want to come, but Sinead will phone them when they have news. Then at the hospital, the doctor has the results of Sinead's scan. Oh, it's not good news. In fact, it's such bad news, they need to start radiotherapy ASAP, which means getting that baby out of Sinead's belly this afternoon. Sinead and Daniel are understandably taken aback by this and would like more time. No can do, says the doc. Are we fetching this bairn or what? It's 27 weeks, and it'll probably be fine. Come on, live a little. And so they go for it. It's like, I think it was an 80% chance that everything would be okay. And then Daniel says, so what about the 20% chance then? Well, presumably, everything isn't okay.
No.
Everything's pretty much really not okay. At the factory, Beth has got news of Sinead, and Carla agrees that she and Kirk can go visit. Izzy and Sean would also like to go, but Carla has to draw the line somewhere, she says, but she's not got much conviction in her words there. Beth is at the hospital, and she's brought the factory gang along to have a baby shower. Daniel's a bit prissy about this, but no one listens to him. Sean has bought risk because there wasn't anything non-foreboding left in Rita's after Kirk had cleared out the cabin of all its teddies. Daniel makes an excuse of getting pups and leaves them to it.
That's probably the best thing since Kirk's grim Reaper outfit.
That was so funny. And I'm sitting watching this thinking, what, they've got no Game of Life left?
Or at least Operation. Come on.
There we go. For the win. Operation.
Yes, no more calls, please. We have a winner.
In the hospital, the party has to wind down as they need to take Sinead away and get that baby out of her belly. There's no sign of Daniel, so Kirk goes off to find him. And Kirk finds Daniel in the hospital's version of the community garden. Daniel's falling to pieces a bit, and then Kirk absolutely breaks down. He can't sleep thinking about Sinead and Daniel and the problems that they're having. And so Daniel has to comfort Kirk and admit that he's terrified too. Kirk gives Daniel a hug and tells him to be strong. That was quite a nice little scene, I thought.
It was. The only thing is, Kirk is always, always a comedy character.
And so, yes!
So rather than going, it being kind of a powerful thing to see him actually break down, I couldn't take him seriously.
You're absolutely right. Because he is just this guy who comes out with random, stupid, nonsensical things, the time that they actually give him a scene where they can prove his acting chops, you're thinking that he's crying about something else, or maybe he was losing at risk or something. You know, there's that opportunity to show him off at his best, and when he did a fantastic job, but I felt exactly the same way. I'm watching it thinking, okay, what's the gag here?
Yeah.
And then there wasn't a gag. I'm like, oh, he really is upset? Oh. Okay.
I had to actually think, well, hang on, what is Sinead to him? All right, that's, and I had to work out the relationship between him and Beth, and then Sinead, oh, okay, yeah, because they didn't strike me as being that close, and then you realise, okay, well, it's his wife's niece.
Yeah, so he's, I guess, by marriage.
Yes.
If they are married.
Yeah, we've been through that one, haven't we? I'm not sure whether they are or they aren't.
No, but he's potentially Sinead's uncle?
I guess so, yeah. But they do tend to play fast and loose with the rules of matrimony in the show, don't they?
Absolutely. And I wonder where Sinead's mother is during all this.
I don't know. At some point you referred to it, say, well, can you, you know, pass a message on to me mum and Auntie Beth? And we have seen the rest of the Tinker clan briefly.
We have.
About a year ago, was it? Something like that? But
it's something like that.
It is surprising and inexplicable that they just wouldn't pop up and say, how are you getting on?
Yeah, or bring some grapes or something and then, you know, show some interest.
Yeah.
But I guess those actors are probably doing something else. So Daniel's back at Sinead's bedside as everyone else is leaving. He admits to being scared, and so is she. This is what he's dreamt of for so long. What? Cancer and premature babies, asked Sinead. What a weirdo. But actually he meant a family.
Aww.
So the C-section is underway, and there we have it. A gorgeous baby boy who's whisked off to neonatal. Then there's bad noises, and Sinead loses consciousness. Daniel is told to fuck off, despite promising Sinead that he wouldn't fuck off. And then he does fuck off. Daniel is falling to pieces in the corridor when a nurse tells him that Sinead is going to be fine, the baby's doing well too, and well, that was quite worrying for a minute.
It was actually quite worrying for about 3 minutes, e.g. the duration of an advert break. And yes. I think that was probably the motivation behind, oh, she's really ill. Oh, no, she's all right.
She's okay. Sinead has woken up and Daniel explains what happened and Sinead wants to see her baby. Daniel tells her why that can't happen yet. She's just had major surgery. In a minute, he gives her the teddy that Kirk gave them and he tells her to hug it so it smells of her and then he can put the baby... No. And then he can put the bear in the baby's incubator. So later, Daniel and Sinead are FaceTiming at the incubator. It's quite moving, but it goes on a little bit too long, and Daniel puts the teddy in the incubator and tells the baby that Sinead loves him to the moon and back, which is a bit twee, isn't it? For Daniel, a bit twee?
Maybe, but I don't know. I can't put myself in that situation. What I was more concerned about was I wouldn't have anything that's been handled by Kirk put in a, you know, a sterile environment. Where's that been?
Oh, I mean, I guess he bought it at Rita's earlier that day, but that doesn't really change anything.
No, not really, no.
Yeah, let's sterilise that little thing first, shall we? So on Wednesday, Daniel comes into Roy's Rolls to a bounty of congratulations from Kate and Tracy, I suppose. The baby weighs a couple of pounds and he has photos. Tracy wonders how Daniel and Sinead could produce something so not ugly. Tracy asks if he'd sent the photos to Ken. Nope. And he's to wait until Daniel says so before visiting. So I thought Daniel had kind of made his peace a little bit with Ken, but it seems not.
No, he's not letting it go, is he?
At hospital, Daniel is lounging on Sinead's bed, belittling the fact that Sinead still hasn't got to see the baby. In comes Ken, pissing Daniel off, but Tracy said it would be fine. Daniel leaves to check on the baby, and Sinead tells him to take Ken. Daniel is now super pissed off. So Ken is cooing at the baby in the incubator, saying all the right things to make Daniel break down. Oh, Daniel. And Daniel doesn't know if he can look after the baby in Sinead and feels like a boy pretending to be a man. He's right, of course.
Yes.
But for some reason, Ken is proud of Daniel and he wishes he'd be the father Daniel is. What?
He hasn't done anything yet, has he?
No. All he's done so far is hand a potentially diseased individual into a controlled environment.
What a role model. Carry on.
Daniel gives him a hug. Then the machines start beeping and nurses want Daniel out, but he would rather they waste their time explaining stuff to him. The second time in as many days, he's told to fuck off out of the hospital, and Daniel eventually does that. But he only does it for a short while and he bursts back into the incubator room demanding to know what's going on. He has a right to know. And the Scottish nurse explains that the baby likely has a bowel condition that is common in premature babies and he's on antibiotics. And then back at the hospital, Daniel has a chance to tell Sinead about the baby's bowels, but he doesn't do it. The baby is called Bertie, short for Albert, says Daniel helpfully, which is his middle name, not named after Ken's Uncle Albert at all. Oh no, sir. And I thought that was a little strange, because I presume that Daniel's middle name is Albert because of Ken's Uncle Albert.
Of course it is, it has to be.
But on Wednesday they kind of tried to make out that that wasn't the case.
Oh, I missed that. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but I missed that.
Well, he seems to say that it's named after his middle name and not Uncle Albert, but maybe I missed that, or maybe I got that wrong, quite possibly.
Okay.
So on Friday, just a few scenes on Friday, Beth thinks that Bertie has been named after the mascot of a licorice company, but Daniel insists no. Beth is going to visit and take the wee man to see Sinead, and Daniel says that she can't do that and then has to explain the lay of the land with regards to Bertie's bowels. Beth goes and she tells Tracy about the baby's new name. Tracy reckons it really is named after Uncle Albert, which, as you quite rightly say, of course it was. Beth explains about Bertie's bowels and how Sinead doesn't even know, and Tracy isn't impressed. Sinead deserves to know, and Beth promised not to say out, but Tracy didn't.
Mm.
So Tracy shows up at the hospital and sees Daniel. She lets him know that she knows about Bertie, and she thinks Daniel should be there with him. She saw Sinead, but didn't tell her. She needs to hear it from Daniel, and Daniel knows that he shouldn't keep the secret, but he's scared that she won't be able to handle it. Plus, saying it makes it real. So Tracy calls Daniel a wimp.
I can see that. What I was surprised in that one is we didn't see Tracy talking to Sinead, did we? She just said she'd been to see Sinead, but not said anything. Is that correct?
Yep, that's what I got from
and
that.
And they are not friends at all.
Tracy and Beth?
No, so Tracy and Tracy and Sinead, and she's supposed to have been to see her, hasn't she?
Yeah.
Wasn't she when, just on the, was it the day of the wedding when everything went horribly wrong for Tracy, where she went in and absolutely ripped into Sinead?
Yep.
And did a fantastic impersonation of her as well.
Oh, it was perfect.
It really was.
Perfect. Well done, Kate Ford. But yeah, the Tracy character has consistently for the last few months pretty much hated Daniel and Sinead.
Yeah, I'd like to have seen that conversation if it happened, how she'd have gone in there and, I don't know, presumably softened a bit towards her, I don't know.
Yeah, because it would have been particularly cruel just to go in and continue to rip.
Not out of character, and certainly entertaining, but probably, No, I think even she'd draw the line at that.
Yeah, another one of those scenes that we'd have rather have had the chance to witness, but yeah. So later, Daniel goes in to see Sinead and he explains what's happened with Bertie. He might need to have a bowel operation. Bertie, that is, not Daniel.
Correct.
And Sinead is now desperate to see the baby. Daniel is doing his best to keep everyone safe, but if Daniel won't help, she will crawl on her hands and knees to see him. So Daniel, the spoil sport that he is, doesn't let Sinead crawl on her hands and knees.
Again, robbed of another televisual feast.
So instead, Daniel wheels her in a chair, her tiny baby Bertie. Sinead calls him perfect, apart from the bell thing, and there really is a totey wee baby in that incubator.
Yeah, I was surprised by that.
Yeah, me too. I don't know where they find these little...
Is there an agency that specialised?
It seems a little cruel if something like that does exist.
Because that was obviously, unless it was a very, very clever piece of CGI, that obviously was, you know, a premature baby. And yeah. how do you approach the troubled parents of a premature baby and say, do you want to make a few quid?
Yeah, this is... We're getting into some kind of dark web territory here, aren't we?
Well, earlier on, you used the expression dead wife line, which struck me as some kind of call service, but carry on. I didn't say that.
So where do you see the storyline going then, Chris?
The general consensus opinion is that the baby will live and Sinead won't. Well, that's one of the numerous scenarios. Do you think that's going to happen?
I was sure that Sinead was going to die until she started taking the chemotherapy.
Yeah, because, I mean, they can't be seen to advocate potpourri rather than chemotherapy. Away with it, you know.
If she was doing the lavender oils and positive thinking, then I think she was destined to die. But now that she started the chemo and potentially the radiotherapy,
yeah,
I think she's probably going to pull through. The baby, are they going to be so cruel as to have a baby die in its first few days?
Well, they're possibly. None of the soaps are afraid of a bit of infant mortality. They will wheel it out when they need to get the ratings up, you know. So I wouldn't think that Bertie's out of the waters yet.
Poor Bertie. So our next story then is Nick and David and Audrey. On Monday, at Roy's Rolls, Audrey and Leanne are reminiscing about how they both got ripped off. Along comes Nick with a gift for Audrey that she doesn't know she already paid for. It's a mini break to Rome, and he hasn't left Leanne out either. He's got her a lovely necklace, and she's made up. In comes Sarah, and Nick wonders what David would like as a prezi. He's had a rough time of it, what with Josh and Callum. And Sarah wonders exactly what Nick knows about Callum, and Nick claims that he knows everything. So Sarah, assuming that he does know everything, says that the only reason Josh is alive is because of Callum. Once is enough, you know? But Nick doesn't know. What does that mean? And Sarah, realising that she said too much, rushes off. And I think what Nick has acquired here is what we call a bargaining chip, although he might not know it yet. And in the background, Leanne is taking sucky face selfies with her new bit of glam jewellery. So I need a little bit of help here.
Go on.
Am I right in saying that Callum was the guy that Kylie killed and Sarah and David buried in number 8's patio?
I can't remember whether or not in the actual scene where he killed, I think he was attacking Kylie and Sarah batted him over the head with a blunt instrument, or the other way around. I can't really remember. Yes, he was the gentleman who ended up under the floor of Gail's annex, as she liked to call it.
Yes, a little granny flat, yeah. So, nobody knows about this though, right?
It's not common knowledge, no. I can't remember whether or not he's still there. No, he can't still be there, can he?
I seem to remember something about that getting dug up and the body getting found, but they managed to get out of it somehow.
Yeah, but I mean, he didn't bury himself in concrete, so you'd think there would be an investigation, unless somebody else was framed for it, which I don't see.
So they found this guy buried in concrete underneath Gail's granny flat annex and thought, got suicide written all over.
It was just an unfortunate accident.
But yeah, he tripped. Yeah. So on the street, Elsa, for some reason, is still in town, and she catches up with Nick and shows some photos from social media of Leanne's new necklace, and she's also heard about the Rome mini break somehow. Elsa gets the feeling that Nick isn't as hard up as he's making out, and is getting her lawyer to do some digging. In the meantime, the divorce is on hold, and Leanne sees them talking and looks on suspiciously. So this was kind of a bit of a silly course of action from Nick to splash this cash that he shouldn't really have.
I think so. It's arisen suspicion, and with social media and everything being linked to everything else, he's not been very clever, has he?
No. Then Leanne catches up with Nick at Dev's. She quizzes him about the meeting with Elsa, and he lies about her being there on business and doesn't mention that the divorce is now on hold. So Nick, kind of continuing, as he's apt to do, always lie. Always just lie.
And he never lies more than when he's just said to somebody, No More Lies.
Great.
But then that's a soap trope anyway, isn't it? You know, this time, no more secrets, no more lies. I invented the television. You know, it's something like that. You know?
My favourite one from recent months is where Robert lies about taking the steroids and has his little heart attack, and Michelle, when she's shouting at him in the hospital bed after he's just had a heart attack, tells him that the next time that he lies, that's it. They're done. And I think he's lied maybe 50 or 60 times.
Something like that. He's just a kind of, I don't know, he's Jude with cooking qualifications, isn't he?
And you're right, because now I kind of feel bad about singling out Jude as being the pathological compulsive liar, because they all are. They're all liars.
Now, I know, as I think we briefly touched on before, we'll have to agree to differ over Jude, because I'm a huge fan of Jude, and I think the fact that we have a character who is a compulsive liar leaves a scope for fantastic storylines. It could be almost anything you can come up with.
Yeah, we were speaking about this yesterday, just as we're trying out the Skype technology stuff, and you made a fantastic point. Yeah, if Jude came back and said that he was a lion tamer, and he really was a lion tamer, but nobody believed him, I think you could get a few episodes out of that.
Yeah, I think so. I think what could also happen is if he came along, if there was something serious, if he'd witnessed a crime and was the only witness to a serious crime, but no one took him seriously, and he said, look, this has happened, and he's trying to get people to believe him. It's the whole boy that cried wolf thing.
Yeah, exactly. If we could get a wolf involved in this, that would just be perfect symbolism.
a wolf and a lion. Yes. I know I've mentioned this, Corrie sometimes isn't that realistic, but, you know, bringing in safari animals is probably a step too far.
I can just imagine you sitting there with your popcorn going, yep, I believe it.
Yeah, I'm there, totally over that one.
Seems perfectly reasonable to me. So on Wednesday, Nick is getting all dressed up and Leanne wonders if he's meeting Elsa today. Some woman keeps on phoning for him. Nick makes some excuses, blaming lawyers, when Imran comes into the kitchen. Imran, he says, is the only honest solicitor in Manchester. Yeah. Leanne just wants this to be over. Why doesn't she get in contact with Elsa's solicitors? That's what she does for a living, after all. She's pretty quiet at the moment. And well, says Nick, if you're that quiet, why don't we bunk off for the day? So that's what they do instead. So Nick turns up at the salon, Audrey's complaining about a smell in her dining room. If only she had Archie's money to get it fixed, and Nick promises to get someone to take a look at it for her, and then he asks to borrow her car. Audrey says sure, but then has to rush out because her last customer left her phone. And when she's gone, Nick's phone goes, and it's someone that Nick clearly doesn't want to talk to. Don't come to me, he says, I'll come to you. And unbeknownst to Nick, David is also in the salon, round the corner, out of eyeshot, and he hears all of this.
Yes, he does.
And David's already suspicious.
I think so.
Yep. So Nick meets up with Leanne at Roy's Rolls. He's late. She thought he was standing her up. And he is. Something's come up. He'll explain later. Then David is in speaking with Shona, and after a fashion explains about the phone call in the salon to Leanne. Very cloak and dagger, he says. And Leanne assumes it was Elsa. Then we see a lady with a lovely butterfly tattoo on the back of her neck walking down the street. Oh, where have we seen a lady with a lovely butterfly tattoo on the back of her neck before? CCTV, I think. Nick is in Audrey's car and pulls up. What are you doing here, he asks. I was coming to you. We can't have people see you here. That's your problem, says the woman. And at this, Leanne appears very keen to be introduced to them. This is Natalie, Nick's solicitor. Solicitor, says Leanne, because this woman could pass for homeless Carol, never mind the solicitor. Oh, homeless Carol.
Whatever happened to?
Oh, it's been so long and Sean never mentions her.
Not in the slightest. He did just drop her like a hot potato as soon as he found somewhere to live, didn't he?
Absolutely. Natalie says this happens all the time. Oh, getting mistaken for being homeless. Leanne is appeased and goes off. David, of course, is hanging about the background and sees all of this. So Natalie and Nick are at Speed Dial, where Nat is enjoying a lovely bit of Pecora. She threatens to get a job here, right on Nick's street, and Elsa seemingly leaves all manner of stuff lying around the restaurant, which is how she got Nick's number and knows that Nick has now loaded. She's the one who withdrew the money, and she says that he got her cheap, and now she wants another 2 grand. Back at number 8, David is quietly listening to Sean and Leanne talk about Natalie and how she was too scuzzy to be a solicitor, and all the while he seems to be adding it all up again. While Shona and Leanne leave for a night out or something, David gets on the phone to police. He wants to see the CCTV lady. He thinks he knows who that might be. Then Nick meets Leanne in the pub and explains about the necklace and the social media thing, which is why Elsa is still sniffing about. She wants more money out of him, and now Leanne is apologetic. So Nick is now making Leanne feel bad about Elsa sniffing around when it's really got nothing to do with Leanne, has it?
Not in the slightest. He's just a master manipulator of that kind of thing, isn't he?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty nasty right there. The police are showing David the CCTV footage. They have a decent shot of the woman's face and off the back of her head and the tattoo. And David almost reacts, but then manages to contain himself and says that he's never seen that woman before in his life. But now, of course, he knows exactly what happened to his gran's money and he has the proof. Later at the Rovers, Nick suggests that he and Leanne have dinner at the bistro. When David arrives, this quickly develops into the whole family going. Nick needs to go freshen up, and David offers to take him to the salon for a quick tidy. So at the salon, he's dabbing foam in Nick's face, and David says he wanted to branch out into barbering. That was a plan until Audrey lost her 80 grand and pulled out of retiring. He gets the straight razor out, and as he's shaving Nick, David says when he gets his hands on the chance to who did it, it'll be a short conversation, and he starts shaving Nick's neck, and Nick shits himself a little bit.
I did actually find that quite threatening and uncomfortable.
Oh, absolutely. With that knife there at his throat, and David?
He has got previous for losing the plot.
So the shaving continues and Nick is blaming Audrey for not hiding passwords and stuff, plus these scammers go from bank to bank, they don't care about the victim, and David doesn't know how they can sleep at night. And as he nicks Nick's face, he reveals that he knows it was him. David tells him all about the CCTV and the tramp stamp on the neck, and then Nick eventually comes clean. He says it was just a loan, a chance windfall. He was in debt to Elsa, he couldn't afford to lose Leanne, and anyway, he says David's done a lot worse. Yeah, but David's paid for his crimes, and Audrey needs to know this wasn't her fault and that Lewis loved her, and he throws down the blade and storms out just as Nick gets another call from Natalie. I thought David was quite good here, being kind of loyal to Audrey and knowing that it was important to her that Lewis knew, or that she knew that Lewis loved her.
Yeah, I thought he'd make a bit more of that, and he kind of didn't, but he did plant the seed, and that, so we do know that that's one of his reasons for wanting Nick to do the right thing.
Yeah. So David is at the bistro with the rest of the family. He's about to spill the beans when Nick comes in and drags David off to the bar. David was just about to broadcast his news, and Nick, who, if you remember, picked up that nugget from Sarah earlier this week, tells David that he'll go to Callum's family and do some explaining of his own, maybe get the case reopened. David doesn't think Nick would do that to Sarah and the kids. "Try me," says Nick. "I'm done being Mr. Nice." So we're led to believe that Nick to this point was being Mr. Nice, are we?
Yeah, seemingly so. I mean, I think what that does tell us is it must be, because he said about not, you know, throwing Sarah under the bus. Presumably it must have been Sarah that delivered the killer blow then, I guess. And that's his bargaining chip, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rather than Kylie doing the killing, it must have been Sarah. And I apologise to anyone who knows better. But it seems, yeah, that's the way it seems to me.
Yeah, I think when you said that, I think Callum was attacking Kylie and Sarah came to her aid, so that does ring a bell.
Yeah.
I may have looked this up in Hindsight Corner already, but if not, I shall do it again for next week. So on Friday in the salon, David is quizzing Sarah about telling Nick about Callum, and she explains how she was hoodwinked. Oh, and by the way, Gary's also known for about 6 months. So Gary's at the salon investigating a leak, and he reckons that there's dry rot. Audrey's mortified. That cost thousands to fix last time. All she has that's worth anything is the salon, and she might not have any choice but to sell up. Maria is scunnered, and David listens on.
Can you add a second? Maria is what?
Scunnered.
Spell, please.
S-C-U-N-N-E-R-E-D.
Absolute nonsense. Explain.
She's infuriated and pissed off.
Okay. I'm going to try and popularise that south of the board. I won't succeed. We'll give it a shot. It's a good word.
David has gone round to Nick. He has to give the money back before Audrey sells up, and David is out of a job. Nick plans to return the money, then someone found out about it. But he has a plan. Why doesn't David use the money to buy Audrey out? David becomes his own boss. Audrey gets some cash back, and Nick gets the time to figure out how to get the rest of the money back. David isn't about to lower himself to Nick's standards, but Nick explains that this is a perfect solution. Meanwhile, Claudia has turned up at the salon. Audrey sent a text wanting to bury the hatchet. Audrey so apologises for her accusations, she totally, totally overreacted. I thought that line, or those two lines, were obviously written by somebody who wasn't Audrey's age. Audrey so apologises and says that she totally, totally overreacted.
Yes, fair point. That's not the parlance of an 80-year-old, is it?
No. Claudia accepts, and then Audrey cuts to the chase. How would Claudia like to buy her half of the salon? And Claudia thinks that she could get the papers drawn up today, jumping all over that. She'll even keep Audrey on as a senior stylist and keep David on as well. And they shake on it. Then Nick goes to work on selling his plan to David. David was going to get the salon anyway, this just speeds it up and skips the inheritance tax bit. But David still isn't buying and reckons that Nick sounds a bit like Josh. David isn't letting anyone control him like that again, and Nick's got to the end of the day to fix this, or David's going to spill the beans.
Now, I had a problem with this business. Again, we're perhaps, as I say, we're overanalyzing these things, but the deal, they shook hands on a deal without any money being mentioned at all. And that happens a lot. And I could get the papers drawn up today. I mean, that happens all the time when I think the... How many times has the factory changed hands since you've been watching?
Three?
And I think we had three or four different owners of the Rovers in the space of 24 hours at some point. You know, yeah. anyone's ever tried to even just, like, buy a small terraced house? You can't do that in a day, let alone become landlord and owner of a public house or a large factory.
Yeah, I think the last thing the Rovers got changed hands was, it was a deal that was agreed in the gents' toilet after Johnny thought over the course of a pint that he would maybe quite like to own the pub. They made an offer which was accepted, and Peter and Toya moved out,
yeah,
while Johnny and the Connors moved in during a working day.
That's correct.
Well, business was going on, and I think I'm pretty sure there was no paperwork.
Well, in between him saying he'd like to sell, sorry, Peter saying he'd like to sell, if you remember, Gemma and Henry were the owners about half past ten, and about midday. They were the owners because she was pissed off because, you know, that was supposedly her future, and then her friend Jenny had thrown her under the bus.
Yeah. So,
and they even got as far as having that. Didn't they have the cocktail night when she was making her, what were they called?
Oh,
Uber Duber's cocktail.
That's well done. Yeah,
Uber Duber. There you go. Well, as I say, it was probably 48 hours where there was three different owners without so much as anything being, a document being signed.
Just paperwork getting drafted up. And it's by Adam as well. That's what galls me. It's Adam is the one that's probably drafting all this stuff up. And he's the world's worst lawyer. But anyway. At the salon, the Champers are out again. In comes David and Gail for some reason. Audrey explains that she sold her share to Claudia, and David is, once again, absolutely outraged. Did no one think of speaking to him first? And Audrey didn't reckon he had the money, and Claudia says David's job was guaranteed. This cuts no dice with David. You can stick your job up your arse, Claudia. Right up your arse. Then he scooshes on with conditioner and storms out. At number 8, David called Nick in for a meeting. He's changed his mind. He wants the money after all. The salon's been snapped up by Claudia, and after David's year of hell, he deserves better than this. But wait a minute, this isn't the deal that they discussed, says Nick. Audrey doesn't get the money, but this is the deal, and Nick can take it or leave it. Nick, suddenly high and mighty, accuses David of stealing Audrey's money. Two peas in a pod, bro, says David. And this is quite a drastic 180 from being all about family to being all about stealing money from Audrey now.
Yeah, it's quite a big switcheroo, isn't it? And at this point, neither of them has the moral high ground here, do they?
No, no. So Nick and David exchange Kylie-related barbs as both try to seek strategic position on the moral high ground. David going out with the mother of the guy who killed Kylie, Nick the guy who did Kylie behind David's back. Is it any wonder, Scrappy-Doo, says Nick, and David lamps him and then storms out for the second time today. At the Rovers, Claudia doesn't know if she wants David in her empire now. Gail says that she's keeping out of it, even though David has worked his entire adult life, and does Audrey really want to leave it like this? And that's Gail keeping out of it. Then Audrey gets a text from him, summoning her. So Audrey and Nick meet David outside an empty lot round the corner on Victoria Street. David announces he's going into business with Nick, and this is going to be their new barber shop. Ta-da! Audrey's not sure about this. Claudia is going to go spare. David says Ken and Craig aren't their target market. They're going for Adam, Ryan, and that alley. Buff guys, then. Nick says it's not a done deal, but David knows the owners are keen to rent. This is going to be a gold mine.
Well, they've got a target demographic of three people. Most of whom have beards. I'm keen to see. I want to spend the money on the posh coffee machine and do you say pool tables or pinball?
There's a pool table mentioned, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think he just wants to open a youth club, doesn't he?
That's exactly what it is. There'll be a dartboard, there'll be a beetle drive. Oh, it's just going to be such fun for the hipster population of Weatherfield. Audrey's back in the Rovers with David and Nick. They share the news of the barbers, and Claudia is not amused, and nor is Nick, at getting railroaded into it. And that's how we finish that storyline for the week. So, I guess the barber would give people other places to go and talk. But we already have a salon. Do we need that?
Well, they've built the Victoria Street extension with a view to being able to expand into it. Because they've got six episodes a week. And yep. A limited number of destinations or locations in which shit can happen. Yep. So obviously, bit by bit, we're being introduced to things. You know, we're never going to go into Costa. We're never going to go into the Co-op.
No.
At some point, we might get to see the inside of the tram station. Obviously, we've had a sneak preview of the snooker hall. Yep. The tattoo shop is going to come online at some point, isn't it?
You've got to think so. It's there for a reason. So.
And then there's that big block of real estate which they haven't used yet, which I think it'll get going. I think it'll get off the ground. Because as we know, it doesn't need to be something. Businesses don't need to be feasible in the real world in order to survive.
No, it's like that little ribbon shop that you mentioned in Bath. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Why not have a ribbon shop in Weatherfield? Yeah, so it's either Roy's Rolls, the Rovers, the Knicker Factory, the Community Garden.
Speed Dial,
the Salon, the Bistro, and now we're adding a barbershop or youth club, potentially.
Yeah, put it that way, there's quite a lot of locations, actually, but you know, there's also a lot of characters and a lot of screen time to fill.
Yep, yeah.
What I want to see, just harking back briefly to the plats, is they haven't heard any more about the cabin in the woods holiday, which Audrey's bought for everyone, and I want to see that.
A cabin in the woods. Yes.
I want to see that because she hasn't said, oh, well, I'll cancel it and get me money back. She's paid for them to all go on holiday, obviously, presuming everybody's available at the same time. And I think you could do a separate standalone one-hour special about that.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, because that has been paid for. That was out of the account, so we know for a fact that was paid for. And if we've learned nothing from Eileen's Holly Bobs from a few weeks ago, there's no refunds to these things.
No,
you don't
not.
Get your money back. Yeah, that would be interesting. And again, it's going to be one of those things that's going to happen. We're not going to get to see it. I worry about that. But yeah, a cabin in the woods that's kind of like the movie Cabin in the Woods, I'd really like to see that.
I'm just currently miming the idea of something flying over my head there as a non-movie watcher. So I'm assuming there is such a thing as Cabin in the Woods, but I've not heard of it.
Yeah, it's a horror movie.
Okay. Well, in that case, all the better to make a remake with the Platts in it.
Yes. And, please, Corey, please do that.
And David packing his cutthroat razor. What could possibly go wrong?
Oh, it writes itself, man. There we go.
Oh, yeah.
So our penultimate storyline for the day is Kate and Rana.
Grown.
I'm going to complain about Kate a little bit. So there we go. So there's not an awful lot to this.
She got an open door here, Gavin. Carry on.
Yep. On Wednesday, Kate and Rana are at Roy's Rolls, and Rana's down in the dumps because her decree absolute came through and she's going to have to meet up with Stan to dissolve their Nika. Rana doesn't think she'd be 27 and divorced, and Kate, turning the knife somewhat, says soon Kate will be 28 and married to her. Run like the wind, Rana. Run like the wind.
Out of the frying pan. Carry on.
At the Rovers, Rana's back already. It went fine. Zidane struggled with the talak, but the imam was great. Now they can give notice on the wedding. Kate tells Johnny to get right in that speech, and a positive Johnny isn't even sure he'll make it. He might be in prison. And Rana, on reflection, is okay postponing the ceremony until Johnny gets out. Michelle's back from wherever it was that she went to. Her fringe is gone and the eyebrows look largely back to normal. She meets Rana and Kate in the back room of the Rovers. They discuss the wedding and getting a late licence at the Rovers to keep the cost down. And Kate has a sly little look that suggests she either doesn't want it in the Rovers or she doesn't want to keep the cost down.
It stuck out to me that I can't remember, that I think it was Kate who said, oh, sorry, we'll chip in towards the wedding. Oh, very big of you.
Yes.
We'll chip in towards the wedding, obviously assuming that somebody else is going to pick up the tab.
Ugh. On Friday, Imran and Rana are coming out of Costa. Rana wants to know how likely it is that Johnny will get sent down, and Imran, despite all those years of BA lawyer school, refuses to speculate. Then back at Roy's Rolls, Kate and Rana are having a chat about the wedding. Kate looks down in the dumps. It seems the dress she wants is $5,000. Now, bearing in mind I didn't have $3,000 a few weeks ago to pay for a cycle of baby treatment when she had the baby fever, this does seem out of their budget. But Kate pretends that she doesn't really want it anyway. It's just whenever she thinks of the wedding day, she's in that dress. Is Kate about to be selfish again here?
It does seem that to be the case. She'll find a way to justify $5,000 for a frock.
Yes. She says she's over it, but Rana looks down and to the right, and we all know what that means. Carla happens upon Rana and the Rovers. Rana, thanks to Kate, is now haggling over the budget for the wedding. It's corned beef sandwiches and box wine, which actually sounds pretty good to me. I miss corned beef. I really miss corned beef.
Is it not something you can get over there?
What they call corned beef here is really what you'd call brisket.
Right.
Or pastrami. It's kind of like, it's not the, you know, the big block or something that you can then...
That's a different beast altogether, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Carla orders the vino. She's got a wedding to help organise, and Gemma offers to help, but Carla and Rana are not interested. Rana explains about Kate's $5,000 dress. Mary's there and observes that the dress is fancy but not too complicated. Carla reckons it's lace, which is why it's so expensive. Then Mary says, Rana, meet Carla, the owner of a knicker factory that uses lace. Carla, meet Rana, a lesbian in need of a lacy wedding outfit. Well, what do you know, says Carla. I thought that was pretty funny.
Maybe I like that. Yeah.
So that's where we got to with that little storyline. So, yeah, Kate's going to be Kate all about this, I think.
She's just a nightmare, an absolute nightmare.
And I know they write her this way. And it's sometimes quite hard to separate, you know, the actor from the role. But this is not the actor. This is the role that she's been given of Kate is written down somewhere, probably near the top of the page, that Kate is really selfish.
Mm.
Every opportunity that they get, they just reinforce that by making her even more selfish.
I don't know if she came in like that or whether that's the way she's kind of become over the last, you know, 18 months, 2 years, or however long she's been in it.
She was always spoiled, I think, wasn't she?
Mm, yeah.
But she's just been up in the ante on being selfish this past 12 months. There's always been something, and she always kind of does it the wrong way and then promises that she won't do it again and then promptly does it again. But
what's her current employment status?
She works at the bistro.
Oh, that's right. Of course she does. Yeah, sorry.
And she sometimes does temping at the Rovers.
Fair enough.
So she's not earning a fortune, I don't think.
No. But it would be fair to say she's just sitting there lapping up Johnny's money. Okay, fair play.
Pretty much, yep. Good for you. So our final storyline for tonight, which I was quite surprised was going to be our final storyline for tonight, is Steve and Tracy. On Monday at Lizzie's, Steve and Tracy are home. Yay! Liz is filling them in on the attempted murder stuff. Steve is oddly relaxed about it. Liz is wearing purple spandex trousers.
I was deeply traumatised by those.
And you probably see more purple spandex trousers than most people in your line of work.
I only have to look in my wardrobe. The days when I would fit into them are long gone, but I have sported such apparel.
They're stretchy for a reason, Chris. Tracy is exhausted after the holiday because it seems that Steve gets horny in warmer climes. Liz and Amy leave, and Steve is after his hole again. Tracy isn't game and gets Steve to take care of the laundry instead. Then Tracy is hiding from Steve and the Rovers, but Steve tracks her down and tries to seduce her into getting their hole back at the flat. Tracy needs wood, though, and so Steve says that her hair is good and shiny. I'm not a horse, says Tracy. Well, I'm a fucking stallion, says Steve. Romance me, says Tracy, and Steve is going to romance her brains out later on.
I thought that was surprisingly near the knuckle for Corey, but I liked it.
It seriously was. They were really kind of walking that tightrope. Then Dev is telling Steve that pies aren't romantic. He should get flowers. But Tracy is a florist. Last time he bought flowers from Dev, she went mental. And Dev takes offence at this and then tries to sell Nick flowers. But no one's buying Dev's shitty flowers. At Steve's, Dev has helped organise a romantic night, even though he thinks Tracy is, quote, pure evil.
don't hold back, Dev. Just put it down. Say what you mean.
Then Dev mentions that Addy has more of a sex life than Dev at the moment. Dev has found condoms. So what do you reckon that's all about, Chris?
Well, we're going to find out, I think. Carry on.
So, we saw it coming, didn't we? Nothing is said for no reason.
No pun intended there.
a sexually active AD is likely to knock something up. Then Tracy comes back, suddenly in the mood to get her hole, but she's really playing Steve, pretending to think that they should be having another kid, which Steve definitely doesn't want. Steve pretends to have left the bicky drawer at Streetcars unlocked, so he makes his excuses and leaves. Then on Wednesday, at the florist, Tracy gets Mary to take photos of her with the baby bouquet. She'll send them to Steve to make him think that she wants a baby, and then he won't be begging for his hole all the time. Sledgehammer to crack a nut, says Mary. That's plan B, says Tracy. Again, skating quite close to the wind.
I adore this programme. I absolutely adore it. Carry on, just putting that out there.
Yep, it was great. Mary doesn't think this is a sign of a healthy marriage. And the Rovers, Tracy hasn't sent the photos to Steve after all and is mad at Mary for making her feel bad for doing things that she wants to do. It's called developing a conscience, dear, says Mary. And anyway, the damage might already be done. Steve's brain is like horse manure, very fertile, and after nearly losing her, he'll do anything now to keep her, like having another baby. And Tracy shits herself a wee bit. And at Streetcars, Mary was right. Steve is getting lucky. Dev and Eileen do their best to ward him off. When this fictitious baby is a teenager, Steve will be 58. And this seems to be all it takes to make Steve see sense. But he's still insisting on playing Tracy at her own game here, because later, Steve and Tracy are meeting up at the bistro and he's got her a present. It's folic acid. Tracy admits that she may have jumped the gun with this baby business. It's a tough enough job being a world-renowned florist and brilliant mum to Amy. And Steve admits that he's not on the idea either, so they both get wired in the vino and party instead. So I was getting quite confused whether they really wanted this baby or not, or whether they were just playing each other or not. It kind of got a little confusing.
Well, I could see that they were beginning to perhaps swap places in terms of what they actually wanted.
We're coming to the idea then, do you think?
Well, I think so. I mean, I was a bit surprised that she didn't, if the general opinion was that she'd blow up if she got given flowers as a present, given a pot of vitamins, I think she'd just lose her shit completely, wouldn't she? Anyway, I think that was always being planned, the fact that he was dead against it and she was pretending to be up for it, and then they were going to swap in terms of the making a new baby thing.
Yeah, and then there was going to be equilibrium round about them probably deciding not to.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure if they kind of reached this at this point. But anyway, on Friday, Steve has picked up some pregnancy leaflets from the health centre. And Tracy thought that they'd knocked that idea on the head, but Steve thinks that they're brilliant parents. And they should explore this properly.
We make... I wrote down... I didn't make many notes this week. I'm planning to do some, and I just got so swallowed up in the action that I just didn't... You know how it is. But I did write down Tracy and Steve, quote, "We make really good parents." Yes. And by way of research, I did a bit of internet googling for the worst parents in the world, but it was all far too dark to even mention. Oh, yeah. But so I don't think they're in the top 10 worst parents in the world, but you know they'll be somewhere in the countdown.
Yeah, they're not great.
No.
And so Steve turns up at the florist with with another present for Tracy. This one is an ovulation test kit.
What an old romantic.
First the folic acid. If that doesn't get her, try an ovulation test kit.
Nigel Hayward could have learned a lot from Steve McDonald.
Although probably not really required for Audrey. Tracy suddenly has a migraine, but Steve is hoping she's more in the mood for her role a little bit later on. Liz is quite normally dressed for a change when she sees Amy off to school. They talk about the pregnancy leaflets, and Liz thinks it's nothing, but secretly, she thinks it's something. And she heads over to Streetcars to see Steve. She found out from Amy about the leaflets, and Amy's worried about it. What are you playing at? Surely not another kid. And Steve reveals that they're both calling each other's bluff about it. It's nothing, but Liz doesn't think this is fair on Amy. What's he going to tell her? He thinks about it, accompanied by a Muppet face.
It's been a while.
It has been a while. I was quite pleased to see it. It wasn't a great one, but one is better than nothing.
So. I'll take what I can get at this point.
Back at the florist, Tracy's reflecting on her time on Daniel's storyline. Maybe a baby isn't such a bad idea after all. Mary calls Tracy out for basically letting Amy raise herself, of putting in a half-arsed effort in the florist, and tells her she's past her prime. Tracy tells Mary she's off the godmother list, but then can't think of anyone else better qualified, or anyone else who likes her for that matter. Yeah, she's warming to the idea, but doesn't know if she has the energy. What about Amy, asks Mary, and Tracy thinks, yeah, Amy could do most of the work if her pocket money was upped. In the Rovers, I thought that was just so Tracy.
To be fair, Amy is very, what's the word I'm looking for? Mercenary. So she probably would, you know, change nappies at £5 a go.
Yep, she thinks it's the worst idea in the world, but sure, some dory me and she'd be all over it.
Precisely.
In the Rover, Steve and Tracy have admitted that they were winding each other up about the baby. It was all about the bants. But Tracy wonders if a baby is such a bad idea. Barmy Gemma thought Steve had boycotted the place, but the Weddy Arms is too far to walk and the landlord of the Flying Horse is a homophobe. Well, that took a turn. Steve is worried about Amy and Tracy reckons that she'd come round. Back home, Steve and Tracy are drawing up the pros and the cons list. No sleep and no social life, but they quite like babies. Then in comes Amy to vote no. Steve likes the family the way it is, and for some reason they group hug as they agree not to procreate. But then, someone's in the bathroom holding a pregnancy test, and it's come back positive. Steve's outside and his back teeth are floating and he's pounding on the bathroom door to get in. Get a move on you. And we're led to believe it's Tracy that's in the bog. But no, it's not Tracy that's in the bog. It's Amy. She's up the duff. Who'd have thunk it? And that is how we end this week's episodes.
That wasn't something I was expecting.
I kind of thought once Dave mentioned the condoms, because we had this thing with the two of them some weeks ago where they thought that the two of them... Amy and AD were going to get together.
That's right, they were trying to hook them up in the bistro, weren't they?
Exactly, trying to hook them up, and Amy said, oh, no, but I kind of thought maybe she protested a bit too much.
Yeah, possibly.
And as soon as Dave mentioned that about the condoms, I thought, yep, that's going to be it, because if there's a condom, you're going to better believe there's going to be a condom that failed, and this is bad news for Amy.
Do you think it could be a kind of a false cliffhanger and it is actually Tracy's and she's just picked it up?
Oh, I hadn't thought that, but that's a good possibility.
The only thing is we don't know in the timescale how long it is since Steve and Tracy have actually got it on.
Yeah.
So that might or might not be a factor.
Yeah, we see maybe wandering the desert at that point when this would have been feasible. Well, he's probably back by then, I would have guessed.
Yeah, I would think so.
It's been a while since we've had a teenage pregnancy storyline, though.
Yeah, the, I guess the last one was Tim's daughter, whose name I've forgotten.
Faye. Oh,
come on. Faye, yeah, of course.
Yeah. So maybe we are heading that direction, but there is going to be a new baby in that flat, but it ain't going to be Tracy's, it's going to be Amy's, and that is going to make Tracy a grandmother.
How will she handle that?
Oh, I'm sure she'll handle it well. Oh. Not a chance. Not a chance.
Can I have a Gavin preview of how Ken will deal with it, please?
Oh, Amy.
There you go. That's precisely what it is. Oh, and given the main protagonists here are members of the Allahan and Barlow family, what's Deb going to say?
Oh, he's going to be furious. He's going to be disgusted with us.
I think there's going to be a battle between the two parents to see who's led the other two on. It's clearly, you know, having such a terrible example, he's going to be calling out Amy's mum for being, you know, obviously Amy was doing all the running and taking advantage of his little boy, and then vice versa.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can just see it. You can see that episode already, the two of them going at it, blaming each other. Yeah, that's definitely going to happen. Well, I think I'm actually quite looking forward to that.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Asher and Addy haven't had very much to do for a very long time.
Exactly.
But this is possibly before your time, but one of my favourite lines was, were you watching it when Blanche was in it? Deirdre's mum?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, she was great.
Well, when the kids first came along, you know, and they just come along. I remember her having a conversation with Dev and goes, oh, I'm surprised that you named the kiddies after the competition. He goes, what do you mean? Of course, you know, Asda and Aldi.
Only Blanche could get away with that.
Exactly. Or probably Evelyn, who is kind of the pound shop Blanche anyway. But I do like Evelyn.
Pound shop Blanche. That's brilliant. Yeah, that's exactly what she is. So do you have a moment of the week?
I've got three to pick from, but I haven't quite decided. I was initially going towards David saying, no, this is juvenile behaviour, and then going postal with the conditioner. Again, yep. phrases you rarely hear. What was the other one? I did enjoy Sally jousting with the estate agent sign.
Yes.
But what I actually did was, and I was quite confused by this for about the second half of the week, I'd written down BPM question mark. I know you've got, only about an hour and a half ago as we started this, I remember it was Baked Potato Meltdown, which was when Sally absolutely lost it. And we had, say, Baked Potato probably four times in a minute. So I'm going to go for Sally's Baked Potato Meltdown. Oh, no, I'll tell you what, there was another contender, but it was one of these blink and you'll miss it moments, which is where Gemma was squeezing her spots onto the same towel that she cleans the glasses with.
Yes.
But I'm going to stick with the Baked Potato Meltdown, the BPM, if you will.
I'll absolutely go along with that. And I noticed the Gemma thing as well. And if only she was eating with her mouth open as she did that would have just made it...
That would be the grand slam of disgusting behaviour.
But I think the Baked Potato Meltdown is our...
Moment of the week!
Boring of the moment of the week.
Boring of the moment of the week. So boring that it didn't even warrant a mention in your comprehensive pre-C. Is he going on about broccoli? And that was a good 30 seconds of screen time explaining about broccoli.
Yeah, and how the kid likes broccoli.
Why?
Yeah.
Asked.
Yeah, I skimmed over. I deliberately didn't mention that.
Do you have something else in mind?
No, I think I think that wins because it was so boring that I didn't write it down. I think this may be the second time that the boring moment of the week is something that I didn't mention, but that absolutely is our...
Boring moment of the week.
Excellent. So do you have anything you'd like to plug, Chris? What's next for you?
Anything I'd like to... That's a good question. You got me on the spot there.
Told you I was going to do that, shouldn't I?
Yeah, well, that's okay, but then it wouldn't have been putting me on the spot. My brother and I have a YouTube channel where my brother's 5 years older than me, and we both started playing guitars about 40-odd years ago, but only got round to doing anything together about 5 years ago. And if you look on the YouTube for Zodiac Space Dogs...
Zodiac Space Dogs.
Origins of the name lost in the mists of time. And you'll see a very silly man who's 60 years of age, my brother, behaving, prancing around like a tit. His words, not mine. And very occasionally me lurking in the background. More often than not, I prefer to just wheel to the camera / iPhone. So, yeah, go and have a look at that. I think there's 6 or 7 songs of dubious and varying quality.
Oh, fantastic. I look forward to seeing
it. It keeps me busy. And in the few hours I have when I'm not watching Corrie, watching Emmerdale, listening to The Archers, or listening to podcasts about all of them, that's what I like to do.
It's good that you have a hobby.
Yeah, it gets me out of the house.
Excellent. For anyone listening in Michigan, I'll be at Everybody Reads Books and Stuff from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday, 26th of January, at 2019 East Michigan Avenue in Lansing. This is a series put together by my friend and poet Alan Harris that's running monthly until March, I believe. And it's for writers with new or reasonably new novels. I'll be reading excerpts from the Scottish Book of the Dead and doing a quick Q&A and hopefully selling some units from the trunk of my car. So it is 11:50, but it's 11:50 in the AM, not the PM that we usually do this. So we're a little bit later getting this one done and posted. But shall we wrap this up, Chris?
I think we probably should. I'd like to say thank you for inviting me to step in and fill the very large shoes vacated temporarily by your wife.
Thank you so much for doing it. This is at such short notice as well, and we've been doing this on Skype, and we practiced yesterday for a little bit, and I think this has been...
We've got away with this, I'd say.
I think we might have. Yeah, I think we just might
to
have.
To be honest, you did mention that obviously plan A was Helen doing it, and I like to think I'm plan C, and plan B you mentioned was getting a 10-year-old niece of yours to do it.
Oh, my stepdaughter, yeah. She
stepdaughter, yeah, who's never seen the program. I think you probably get more rational and, you know, impartial insights from a 10-year-old child, but there you go. As I say, we got away with it.
We got away with it. And looking through my notes, yeah, I probably shouldn't have read any of that out to Stelly. So anyway, so if you have an overwhelming desire to get in contact with us, and who can blame you, our email address is thetalkofthestreet@gmail.com. And I believe you can use the same address now to leave us a voicemail on Skype if you like to do that, because that's quite interesting, isn't it? We're at Corrie Podcast on the Facebook and the Twitter. We have a blog, thetalkofthestreetpodcast.wordpress.com. Thanks for making it to the end of another episode. I'll be back next week with a hernia-free Helen, hopefully, and more Talk of the Street. And thanks again to Chris for joining me. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Baked potato meltdown.